This is Realms of Memory. I'm Rick Dedarian. In the 1970s, Kai Froebel was a West German high school student living a stone's throw from the highly militarized border with East Germany. An avid bird watcher, Kai noticed something unusual happening along the border. A rare songbird called the windchat was actually thriving in one of the most securitized places on Earth. Kai went on to map the nesting patterns of the windchat and published his findings as a way of shaming the West German government. If the windchat could flourish along the Death Strip, why couldn't West Germany do more to protect it? Kai is now an environmental ecologist heading up the Nuremberg office of the Bund, one of Germany's largest environmental groups. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of Germany, he played one of the leading roles in the transformation of hundreds of miles of the former border into a conservation zone called the Green Belt. He and other environmentalists at the Bund hoped to make the Green Belt an ecological corridor and a sanctuary to protect and promote Germany's biodiversity. What they never anticipated was that memory would become a core part of their work and a central feature of the Green Belt. This week, we'll look at how Germany's largest environmental project became a model for how to incorporate memory into conservation work. At Bates College in Maine, Sonja Peek is a professor of environmental studies. Sonja argues that landscapes are layered with different kinds of human and non-human memory, or what she labels as mnemonic ecologies. She calls on conservationists to take a mnemonic approach to their work that recognizes and incorporates the many ways that nature and memory are interconnected. Sonja believes that mnemonic ecological conservation work has the potential not only to heal the most wounded lands, but also to make them places of healing. How this is happening in the Greenbelt is the focus of Sonja's book, Mnemonic Ecologies, Memory and Nature Conservation Along the Former Iron Curtain. Sonja, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So you mentioned a little bit about yourself at the start of your book, and that I'm always interested to find out the background of who's writing the book. And you mentioned that you grew up in West Germany, and you lived through the fall of the Berlin Wall, unification, but the borderlands were kind of a fuzzy space that you wanted to learn more about. So why was it a fuzzy space? Why didn't you know more about it? What did you end up learning in the course of your research?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So as I mentioned in the book, I'm German, and I was born in West Germany in Bonn in 1975, and Bonn was pretty much as far west as you could get in Germany, both geographically and ideologically. I actually had very little connection to the border of any kind. I grew up also in a diplomatic family, so I spent important formative years in Germany, but we were also moving around a fair bit. But I was in Germany, like you said, during the years of the reunification when the border fell. I remember the complete incredulity that my parents had when they just were just completely flabbergasted that it had happened, seemingly so fast. And they kept saying, I'd never imagined that this would happen in our lifetimes. The West German school system at the time taught very little about the GDR. I had never seen the border personally until I began the fieldwork for this book. But my parents both lived through as children through the Second World War, and my mother especially fled East Berlin with her mother ahead of the Soviet army. And so part of my history is in fact wrapped up in the story of the partition. And it was a desire, I mean, I'm trained actually have been trained as a Latin Americanist geographer. And I was sitting in Lima, Peru, doing another project. And it just hit me that I had such a strong desire, especially in the years after my mother passed away, to learn more about this part of Germany's past, part of my past. And so what also helps is that the story of the Greenbelt is also just so fascinating in and of itself. So that's a little bit sort of where I came in. This was a fuzzy place in my consciousness, the borderlands. I was never truly educated on it. And I really wanted to learn more. It felt really important to know.
So really, your work had taken you to a completely different part of the world, and this was a way of coming back and learning more about your home and your past. So one thing you emphasize is if you're looking at this borderland space, and this is almost 35 years on, we forget. A lot of the traces of it were quickly eradicated, removed. That this was one of the most highly militarized spaces in the world. Can you talk a little bit about how this border zone came into being as such a militarized space, and how it affected the people who were living there during the process that it was coming together and afterwards?
Right. So after the Second World War and after the collapse of the Nazi regime, Germany was partitioned into four different occupation zones. And the east of Germany was essentially given to the Soviet Union to administer, at least initially. And by 1949, so just 4 or 5 years after the end of the war, the Soviets, with Soviet help and sort of the emerging East, socialist East German state, with Soviet help, began demarcating a much more formal border. And it was a demarcation line and it became increasingly a fortified border over decades. So by 1952, 1953, you get actually some physical infrastructure that gets put in place, initially just a fence. First, it was barbed wire, then it was actually something more significant. At some point, by the time you hit the 60s, 70s, as the Cold War gets worse and worse, you see more and more militarized infrastructure going in. So to build the border, the East German state relocated somewhere around 160,000 people, forcibly relocated at gunpoint, about 160,000 people. The East Germans basically steamrolled through, and they clear cut and they just plowed over land in the middle of Germany, right along this demarcation line, and to put down the border, put down the fence, put down what became minefields, high voltage fences, sniper towers. Like it was corrals, like kennels for guard dogs and all sorts of things. There was a anti-vehicular ditch, so somebody couldn't just drive, like plow through the fence, drive across the border. All kinds of machinations, all kinds of technology went in to make that border. I mean, it was right plowed through the middle of Germany, and with it, 300 towns and villages were destroyed, razed, and just completely erased on the East German side, right after people were forcibly relocated out of them. And the death count, which is somewhat of a controversy and debated still in Germany, is somewhere between the death count immediately of people who tried to escape the East for the West, somewhere between 400 and 900 people died in this border zone. People were shot in the back by snipers who were sitting in those guard towers, or they were blown to bits by the minefields that went in and sections. And when Berlin closed, when the Berlin Wall went in later on, I believe it was in the 60s, it closed an escape valve for East Germans. And that increased the flow of potential escapees, so it increased the pressure along the rest of the German border, right? So that's when also you see an uptick in infrastructure to try and prevent that kind of population loss. So highways were cut, right? Like just cut. The trade between those two Germanies was cut. The border region becomes isolated. And suddenly people who used to live in the center of Germany suddenly lived in its periphery. And economic decline was very rapid, right? Local industries, crafts, industry, everything sort of was destroyed economically. And people in the East, of course, I mean, the often unspoken tragedy is that people in the East lost access to family members in the West. And it got ultimately, you know, the border became an isolated, quiet space in that sense.
So you have the process of reunification, but long before, there are people who realize that there's something particular going on along the border. And I was really interested in the story you told of Kai Froebel, who you refer to as the father of the Greenbelt, that he's really part of this early history of recognizing kind of what this unlikely development that seems to be happening along the border. So who is he? What does he discover, and how does he start to create momentum for this project?
So this is the really fascinating part of the story, right? So as the border quiets things down economically and in terms of sort of the highway, the traffic, and the general sort of density of people, those borderlands become refuges for animals and plants that were being displaced elsewhere in Germany by expanding cities and by increasingly industrialized agriculture. And Kai Froebel is often credited with being one of the people. There were also, he had East German collaborators who were noticing it on the other side of the wall as well. Is often credited with being one of the first people to notice this phenomenon. He is a West German ecologist, but he grew up in the immediate vicinity of the border. He could practically see the border fence from his house. And when he was a high school student and then later at university, he had an interest in birds, and he documented the presence of certain bird species that had become rare in Germany. That he noticed that they'd started nesting at higher densities all along the border, like right near all that militarized infrastructure. And how odd is that, right? So he, along with some of his colleagues, his friends and colleagues, uncovered this profound ecological irony of the borderlands, right? That a place of so much death and suffering and militarization had also become a refuge for certain kinds of animal species that were being displaced elsewhere. And so there was this sort of game-changing study of mapping the nesting locations of the windchat, which is a small songbird and had become rare in Germany. And this had become clear before the wall even came down. This was like the late 70s and into the 1980s. People were already noticing this. And there was already a sense like, man, you know, if that wall ever comes down, wouldn't it be amazing if there was some way to protect that aspect of the border? So the wall fell very suddenly and took most people, I think both in East and West, by complete surprise. And in 1989, so there was a meeting. I mean, the wall fell in November, and by December, East and West German environmentalists led by Kai Froebel and his boss, Hubert Weiger, they called for a summit meeting of East and West German environmentalists near the border. And that was a rousing success, that meeting. And at that meeting, with several hundred people in attendance, which they weren't expecting, they were hoping for a dozen people, but several hundred showed up. And they devised a vision for this border space to call it the Green Belt, and that it should be protected for the sort of floral and faunal refuge that it had become. So Kai Froebel is at the center of that story, but he himself would also say that he didn't act entirely alone, that he certainly was working in collaboration with plenty of other people who supported him.
It seems like they have this project in mind. They recognize there's this unique development of species that are surviving, and they go about their work to try to restore and preserve. And a lot of people are upset, and they didn't can take this into account. They didn't anticipate it. And maybe it seems like it's almost like they had certain blinders on, or they were seeing through a certain lens. And I think you stress that has to do with the way in which environmental sciences evolve in Germany. That, you know, you have this long history of conservation work, you know, going back to the 19th century, and Germans did historically have this emotional attachment to the land. And then it evolves, it gets discredited and evolves into something else. And that's what it evolves into, that has this scientific bent. It's really important, and that takes on and gains a particular political magnitude and influence. But it's not able to connect with real people. It's really hard not to think about global warming in the same way. It's like, why can't people relate to global warming? Why is there still so much denial, or people aren't more invested in it? And maybe it's very similar in what happens in the German case. So can you give a sense of, like, there's a learning curve, and you mentioned that these conservationists, it's trial and error. They go out people are hostile. They can't understand it. And eventually they start incorporating some of these memory techniques that are part of your definition of mnemonic ecologies.
So there are interesting connecting points between the history of German conservation and U.S. conservation, but the two are also very distinct. From the beginning, German conservation was really about protecting the cultural landscape, which is not the lineage of conservation in the United States, which was really about protecting a created wilderness, right? And in the United States, conservation is so intimately tied up with the United States westward expansion, settler colonialism, genocide, land theft, all that was that wilderness is predicated on. The Germans never had a sense of wilderness, and so the landscape has always been occupied. There was no history of settler colonialism in the sense of the United States, and so cultural landscape was always the thing that, since the 19th century, when conservation sort of emerged as a movement, you were really protecting what they saw was a sort of agrarian tradition that was being lost due to industrialization and emigration and so on. And from the early roots of German conservation had a very emotional charge to it. It was really birthed from the grief. There is something here that is we're witnessing is being lost, and it's being literally paved over, or it's people who are leaving rural villages for the United States, for example, right? People who are leaving and going into factories, like all these old crafts are dying. Landscapes are being plowed over, industrial agriculture starts to rise, right? Fertilizer, over-fertilization becomes a problem, like forests are cut. And so people are noticing that an old way of life is dying to make way for industrialization and sort of a new classed, oppressive society that takes its place, right? And there are a lot of German theorists who are thinking about that, Karl Marx being one of them, but a lot of people writing at the time and thinking about different forms of alienation from land and alienation from each other. And what does it mean to move into an industrial society and what's getting lost? So German conservation had a deeply emotional charge initially, and it was centered on a concept that doesn't translate all that well into English, but the central concept of conservation early on was Heimat, H-E-I-M-A-T, Heimat. In English, the closest, I think, would be homeland. But Heimat in Germany is filled with nostalgia. It's the place you're from. It's a sense of origin. It's often, you think about it with sort of rosy-colored glasses. It's Heimat is like the place of belonging, right, of origin. And that's what conservation was about. It was about preserving the Heimat. All of that changed because the National Socialists picked up conservation and turned it and like mangled it and turned it into this blood and soil ethno-nationalism, right? Germans belong to the German homeland, and we need to expand it. The Germans need more Lebensraum, and we need to expand it to the east because that is the German homeland. And it gets bogged down in all this like terrible racist kind of discourse. And by the time Germany comes out of the Second World War, the last thing that conservationists or environmentalists want to do is revive that. That has been like tainted in a really bad way. There's no way to talk about Heimat without sounding like you're back in the 1930s. So coming out of the Second World War into the 60s and the 70s, by the time you hit the 70s, the Germans are participating or are also becoming aware, just like the Americans are, of things like global warming. Today we tend to use the words climate change, but pollution becomes a problem, right? Like people are noticing 1972, you get the United Nations Stockholm Conference, which crystallizes a lot of that thinking. But even a decade prior, Germans are reading Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. It's really resonating because they too are seeing the pollution that's happening. We're talking primarily of West Germans, though even in East Germany, some are smuggling those books into East Germany and they're also reading that. So that consciousness gets raised. And so instead of this sort of emotionally laden, Heimat-focused conservation that really described environmentalism up until the 1930s, what you get after sort of the watershed years of the Second World War is an environmentalism that is scientific. Because if you rely on science, that's safe, right? That's seemingly objective, that's apolitical, or it supersedes all politics, right? It's higher level. And you don't want to get emotional about protecting land because we had that and it went really badly. So people are, and again, this is also happening in the United States. The United States is also experiencing, you know, there's a sort of first wave of environmentalists, the John Muir environmentalists or conservationists, and then you get sort of the Rachel Carson people who are using science against science, right? So it's very scientized, scientific. And it certainly has benefits to it. You can speak more clearly to policymakers. You avoid in Germany that sort of morass that of the Second World War. But what you also generate is an environmentalism that doesn't actually really connect to people where they're at, right? So if you just talk in biological or ecological terms, you have now evacuated or you've excoriated environmentalism. So what you lose is people's emotional connection to place. If all you're doing is you're talking about species numbers and ecological dynamics, what you're ignoring is or erasing is that people love the places they're at, or people might have some sort of interrelationship in the place that they live in, right? That they have love for the place. So that's one of the problems, I think, that's this sort of catch-22, because if you're trying to motivate people to protect land, you're going to have an easier time doing it if you reach them emotionally. Like, don't you love this place? Do you remember what this place was, a field full of butterflies, and now it's a parking lot? Don't you want to protect the kinds of spaces so your children get, right? That's an emotional argument rather than an argument of, you know, this butterfly has declined in numbers and it has this ecological role and we need to, you know, recreate this ecological role elsewhere. That's a fine argument, but it I think leaves a whole number of people just sort of estranged from that, like they can't relate to it. So I think that's one of the things that the Greenbelt folks are trying to cope with, right? The Bund is an organization that was created in 1975. It is a creature of that scientific environmentalism. It is not an organization that was born from the earlier emotional conservation movement. And so it is grappling, and it tends to employ ecologists. And so it's grappling with that, right? So the initial impetus after the reunification, like I said, was to just grab that land, hold on to it for dear life, literally, right? For dear biodiverse life, and using ecological arguments to make that case. And what it lost is the emotional element to that, right? And I think farmers, people in East Germany and West Germany both are just sort of sometimes can't quite relate to that, right? I could keep going, but yeah.
So there's a kind of double alienation. In the one sense, they're speaking a language of science that people have a hard time identifying with. And at the same time, they're ignoring a past. They can't understand. They're not recognizing a history of expropriation and how they might be seen as themselves just repeating a past, that they have these green motives that might get filtered through a red past experience. And when they meet people on the ground, right, there's that realization, right? And then memory starts to come into play. And I think you mentioned that there are different efforts to connect with people early on, and they're through this backlash, that they have more collaborative work, that they're trying to expand their maps, right, and have this interactive process of involving people. And that's a common theme that runs through a lot of my episodes. You're trying to have a successful memory project and you ignore people and you don't implicate them, it generally doesn't work that well.
Doesn't work.
So
yeah.
This happens, right? They bring people in, they involve them, they listen to them. Could you explain a little bit how that works?
So initially the Bund did their scientific work the way the Bund does scientific work, and they started reclaiming those lands and basically celebrating the fact that this is a biodiverse refuge and this should become some sort of continuous protected area on ecological corridor. And they ran smack dab into resistance, mostly from East Germans who were really concerned about what they considered to be a reverse, a different form, like you mentioned it already, right? Now we have a green expropriation instead of a red expropriation, right? So East Germans, and we now have enough data to also show. So East Germans, many of them experience trauma at the hands of the sort of the East German state, right? And they experience the trauma of forced displacement of their villages and their homes being destroyed. They experienced what it's like to live in the floodlights and constantly be threatened in your movements or be restricted in what you can do. People who expressed any kind of resistance to the East German state, their careers were torpedoed or they were terrorized into, you know, leaving, or they're so a lot of that work is currently being done in Germany to research and bring to light the different kinds of trauma and so on. So if you're trying to do conservation on land like that, and you just come in with your scientific arguments and you ignore that pain, right? Like land is in an area-based strategy for conservation, which this is, right? There are non-land-based conservation strategies like arboretums, gene banks, and zoos. We're talking about a land-based strategy here. Land, to whom it belongs, who gets to use it, for what purpose, right? Who gets to set what the vision is for that land or what the land's future is? Who gets to say what the land's past is? That becomes absolutely core to the conflict in this place, right? So there was a real fear that after 40 years of socialist dictatorship, right, decades of lack of control, of surveillance, land expropriation, there would be a new round of this. And a lot of East Germans have a fear or a resistance to authority, state authority, that is birthed from 40 years of experience with this. And they have tended, in some cases, to identify the often Western, urban experts, scientific experts with that sort of authority figure that they don't want to have anything to do with it. Doesn't help that a lot of scientists come in thinking they know best and like they have their plans and you can sign on to it or not. So there's behavior among conservationists that is not helping their cause. That's a global problem. But there was a real sense in the interviews that I did that conservation was imposed from above or from outside of the place, right, without any local participation or consultation, like you said, that conservation justifies a new form of expropriation, and that, you know, conservation dehistoricizes the borderlands, right, especially if you're just, like, framing this in science and you think it's apolitical, which I think is also kind of a mythology. Science tends to retreat from politics or thinks that it's beyond that. So, but conservation that's focused solely on biodiversity will dehistoricize the borderlands. It ecologizes. So some German critics have said we've ecologized the border, and that's a problem, right? It erases the victims of the GDR, right? Like it doesn't recognize that on this place, in this space, somebody died or somebody lost their land or so. And then there's a subgroup of people of East Germans who resent the fact that the Greenbelt actually maintains an imprint of the border, right? It is now green. It's not full of militarized infrastructure, but it is still a reminder of the border. And people who live through the border's impact, for a lot of them, they just want the border gone already. Like, they resent the fact that the conservationists are insisting on maintaining it. So there's a whole range of opinions. I don't want to suggest that we have sort of monolithic two camps against each other. There's actually three or four different discernible positions on this, potentially more than that. But yeah, that's been the problem. And it caught a lot of the ecologists and the Bund by surprise. And so after the initial sort of two decades of ecological work, there was a recognition of, it's like, boy, you know, we kind of missed the boat on this. There's a lot of additional work that we need to do. And today's Green Belt really looks different. That work now includes collaboration with border museums that have cropped up along along the former border lines, with museums. They're increasingly in conversation with historians to try and connect the Greenbelt project with histories, not just memories of the border, but actual historical documented histories. With there's even connection to archaeologists increasingly in the last two or three years that has started, where they're actually trying to unearth some of the border infrastructure, some of the remains, because now we're 30, 40 years on, we've got a whole generation of people of Germans who have no concept of the border at all. So they're realizing belatedly, like, oh my God, we actually do need to preserve that infrastructure. So there are plenty of examples that I discuss in detail in the book, but the way in which the Germans have increasingly brought memory into conversation with ecology, I think, is really illustrative and I think inspiring in many ways. It's trial and error. Some things don't work, but you have more participatory approaches. You're talking to local people about, you know, how does land management need to change? You're honoring their past. There's group discussion and events that are happening where you get the generations talking to each other. You are honoring and making public people's remembrance and memory of what it was like back then. There's landscape art that's gone in along the borderlands where you can actually physically experience some remnant of the border, but it's brought into relationship with trees and flowering plants. You can visit some of the ruins of the raised villages, and you can like come into intimate contact with past lives that way. So they're doing, I think, really amazing work on both educating people and allowing themselves to be educated by local people. So yeah, I find it to be a very hopeful story.
So you have this theme of the therapeutic benefits of this conservation work, and this is a common theme with memory, that memory has this healing effect, that if we don't, it's this Freudian idea of the past coming back to get you if you don't confront it, if you don't work through it. But you're tying this into the environment and arguing this is also a part of conservation work, and you miss this if you're taking this, if you're approaching this from the scientific angle, and you include, I thought, this really powerful example of this TV travel personality, right, who's taken on by the Bund, and he's part of the effort to do the work of trying to connect people to the space. And it seems like there's this original intention of how this is supposed to unfold, that this is a recognized guy, he'll draw attention to the Green Belt. And in the end, it evolves into something different that people hadn't anticipated. And it really shows the ways in which that space can help with the presenter's own history and his own personal journey towards healing and how that's connected to the larger community. How does... And this goes back to an understanding of mnemonic ecologies. How is there this therapeutic healing dimension that the Bund realizes, even if it's kind of by surprise through people like this nature travel personality?
Yeah, I think there's an underappreciation how somatic memory is and how somatic trauma is. I mean, we know by now through through various publications today that trauma is held in the body, right, in the tissues. But what I think this example illustrates, so this is a book that was published by Mario Goldstein, who was a former East German who had been imprisoned by the GDR state police, the East German state police in the 80s. He's become famous in Germany. He's kind of an adventure traveler and nature documentary filmmaker, and he, with sponsorship from the Bund, traveled the Greenbelt on his own, and he walked along the former border fence or whatever infrastructure's left, and he published a book that's a compendium of both ecological facts and information and historical tidbits of what happened here along the border and people he meets along the way. But to me, the most evocative and powerful parts of this book were his journal entries, where he documents his personal healing and his own reconciliation with the past as he spends his solitary days walking alongside the border. That he says, like, with every step that I take, this sort of pain falls away from me. Like, I've been repressing this, but now that I can walk freely along the border that so long determined my life, like, I can do this, that there's something like profoundly redeeming and healing about it for him. And that to me was particularly moving. So the fact that there is a book out there that details this sort of somatic experience of healing, of moving through memory to actually unload the sort of PTSD and unload the trauma. And then his conversations with people that he meets, and he realizes it's not just my pain. It's all these people's pain. Like, we're all in pain together. We're all in pain differently. And the way in which we process that needs to not, it can be a solitary journey, but it is also a journey in relationship, right? Memory is a relationship with self. It's a relationship with others. It's a relationship with past and future, right? It's a relationship, right? So Maurice Hartwachs talked many years ago about collective memory, that memory exists not as a solitary experience or a way that we orient ourselves in the world, but it exists in network with others. Memories stay alive because we tell other people about them. So the book is an example of that, that I found really quite powerful. And as you mentioned, from the book or connected to the book, Mario Goldstein did the plan was to do this sort of multimedia tour. So the book is out and Mario Goldstein, the author, is traveling to various sites along the Greenbelt, and he's, you know, it's this event that gets published in the evening where you get to look at his slides and his beautiful photographs, and he tells you about his travels. And this happens along the border, so it's open to former East Germans, right? Gets advertised in those communities. People show up to these evenings, and what initially the Bund thought would be a presentation by Goldstein that goes unidirectionally, basically from Goldstein to the audience, becomes a conversation with the audience. And the audience starts chiming in and says, well, I remember this place was like this and back in the day, and but the GDR state police did this to my family. And it becomes, and then they bring their kids and their grandkids, and the grandkids hear like grandpa talking about this for the first time. And then Goldstein is essentially becomes a moderator for a conversation that has needed to happen for decades, and is now finally there's a space for this to happen, right? Local people see that this landscape is beautiful, that it can produce healing. He's an East German. I think that's really important, right? So they're all now beginning to process and verbalize their traumas, their experiences, their memories of what this was like. And the younger people are hearing this. And so it ended up being just like almost like group therapy, one person described it, right? Like, how amazing. And that you get the generation speaking to each other, which is of course also like a dimension of memory politics that is difficult, because the generations of course have, generations themselves are mnemonic communities and they may not communicate very well. Memory changes generationally. So that was like a really, really important thing to happen. And, you know, that was something that hadn't happened enough, and more conversation, you know, opportunities for that kind of healing conversation was just really readily accepted.
So you have explicit forms of commemoration of the past, are this, these encounters with this travel personality, his conversations that recall the past. But then you also have other ways of doing this in terms of kind of letting nature run its course, right? And you mentioned you can have a site where you just leave it alone, right? And you have the ruins of a community that was leveled to create this border. And instead of preserving it, instead of curating it, you just let the trees and the roots grow back. You let them grow over what was there before. And this is another way of, I mean, you could argue, well, isn't that just a form of forgetting? And I think you try to argue that this is, it's another way of reflecting on the past. It's another lens of another way of remembering. So how does that work? It's a different, more complicated way of thinking about how you recall the past.
Yeah. So there's a tension along the Greenbelt between the places, how should this past or how should this landscape be curated? And to what extent do you want to fix the meaning? And to what extent do you want to leave the meanings up to people? And to what extent do you want to leave it open-ended, right, for individuals to sort of make their own sense of it rather than sort of saying what is here? And that's an ongoing tension. I don't think the Bund has necessarily figured out. I don't know if it's actually something one can at all figure out, and maybe that's just fine. You know, maybe it's good for there to be both kinds of places. The example that I give in the book is the town of, or the village of Jazo, which had existed since the 1370s and was leveled in the 1970s by the East German state. And what's just now left is rubble. A local has gone in and actually put in some signs that he printed off on his own home computer, you know, on his home printer, and has put up some laminated signs that say, this is where Mr. Schneider and his family used to live, and this is where this family used to live, and this used to be the barn of so-and-so. But beyond that little signage, right, you're sort of clambering about the rubble, and, you know, you can find it, you're in the middle of like a young forest that are in the saplings, right, that are essentially disassembling and composting the past, right, like decay, watching the past sort of decay and become something new. It's not like it goes away. It just turns into something else, right? And so you can be in very intimate contact with the past, with people's lives. And it's a very currently very powerful way to narrate or to experience the conditions of removal, the conditions of oppression, like people being, you know, pulled from these homes and the homes being destroyed. And the big question around that becomes, okay, right now it's this powerful experience, right? What happens 50 years on when it's actually, when that's covered with soil and you actually can't even recognize the rubble anymore and the laminated signs haven't held up to the weather and somebody's, or the person who put them up in the first place has passed on and nobody's doing that work anymore and nobody remembers the Schneiders anyway. And so what happens to a place like that without fixing the meaning and without actually making the effort to preserve the material remains, the material culture of a place? So I think that's an open question that I can't answer. I think at this moment, places like that are really, really moving because they're not curated, right? Nobody's telling you what to make of this place, but it is so obvious that something violent happened here. And you're sort of, it's very effective emotionally. And so I think it is more powerful in its understatement than if it were a musealized site. But we will lose it as ecological transformation continues, right? There will be, you know, you'll hear the cuckoo call and, you know, you'll hear the, you know, the mice rustle in the leaves. And it becomes a home for some other creatures, right? So there is an ecological future in this place. But yeah, there's a larger question about what do we do with places like that? And I think the Bund will have to confront that as time wears on. I mean, I think, and I imagine that in other podcasts, you're dealing with this as well, right? Like, what do we do as the survivors of violence slowly die away and we don't have their testimony anymore? And like, how do we hold on to that and make that memory last across generations, right? So, yeah, there are spaces that are not fixed, and that's amazing. And at the same time, yeah, it raises a whole host of questions.
I want to go back to just, I'd like to get your thoughts on this Elbe River, because you talked about that area at length, and this is maybe a way to get at, I guess, both the human and non-human dimensions of memory, because this is a space that, where you have traces of human activity. They alter the river banks. They alter the nature of the way flooding historically worked. So you stress that if you look at what happens in this zone, you can't really fully understand it if you don't understand the history that stretches back to the Middle Ages, or if certain parts of the Elbe River spared, that you really have to understand that through the lens of the history of what East Germany didn't do, or where the border areas ran along. So how do certain areas like the Elbe River recall a more distant, a more recent past? And then if you're trying to restore them, you mentioned you're introducing certain plant species, certain animals to make sure that it doesn't, that you can keep nature at bay. You mentioned certain cattle, certain horses, and even those animals recall a particular past. So in what ways does this area of the Elbe River recall kind of a long environmental memory of past land uses and efforts to restore it, integrate plants and animals as another facet of memory?
Yeah, so it's a complicated, that's a really complicated thing. I mean, the green belt's a very complicated project. It's very long, it's 870 miles or so, and it's a mosaic of different kinds of projects and different kinds of approaches and different kinds of thinking about what needs to happen in different places. So along some parts of the Greenbelt, the task has been to maintain as much as possible the imprint of the border. So in some places, forest succession would just swallow up that formerly clear-cut place if you didn't push the forest back, right? But it's in that clear-cut space where all those species have found refuge. And so the task is to keep that space open the way the border had it. Which is an interesting sort of, Foucault would call it a biopolitical decision, right? Like, it's an interesting choice. But in other places, it seemed more apt to, in fact, allow ecological processes to restore a landscape to what it was before the border went in, and potentially what it was before industrialized agriculture really began modifying the landscape. And the Elbe River in Germany is one such example. So the Elbe is a river, the second largest river in Germany after the Rhine. But unlike the Rhine River, the Elbe was never, because much of it flowed through eastern Germany and the East Germans didn't have any money to re-engineer the river. So today the Elbe has happily escaped a lot of the engineering that has has completely transformed the Rhine River. And so the Elbe, it tends to meander. It's a very slow slope, a very light slope. And so it tends to, as it sort of approaches Hamburg, where it empties out into the North Sea, it meanders across this really wide alluvial plain. And there are towns along the Elbe that get flooded on a regular basis, because the Elbe has still that sort of up and down seasonal flooding, especially in the springtime as the snow melts. And so the Elbe River has been targeted as a site of rewilding. And rewilding is a paradigm that, you know, exists both in the United States, where it has a slightly different connotation, where it's really focused on the West and it's about trying to create like Pleistocene conditions where you're focusing on apex predators and you're trying to create large, vast areas where, yeah, in any case. So in Germany, rewilding is a little bit more domesticated, as it were. But what the Bund ecologists are trying to do is trying to allow the Elbe to behave as quote unquote naturally as they can manage. The Elbe has been diked and has been modified by human activity to make it passable as a trade route and so on. So they're trying to, and the dikes specifically have been a problem because it deepens the channel, which makes it easier for boats to travel along it. But it, of course, also increases the water flow. And it actually, through a complicated series of events, it also increases then flooding downstream and so on. So there are reasons, both social and ecological, to try and remove as many of the dikes as possible. And so in the Elbe River, ecologists worked with a former East German landowner, and the agricultural fields in East Germany, because of collectivization, were much, much larger than in West Germany. So you could work with a single landowner and actually free up a huge swath of land. If he was willing to collaborate with you, you had it made, right, as an ecologist. And so what they did in the Elbe is, among other things, they realized that alluvial forest was a dying habitat in Germany. It had become almost extinct. And here was an opportunity to set the dike back to allow the Elbe to sort of take up more space and take up more of its original floodplain. And that would allow the Germans to put in and plant alluvial forest to try and recreate an environment that they think existed in sort of the middle of the early 19th century. So they went back to maps from the Prussian government and tried to recreate a habitat that they say pre-existed, high intensity, expansive agriculture, and certainly pre-existed the partition. And that project is up and running, and it has been generally declared, is considered generally to be a success, right? That floodplain has been reclaimed by the river. The alluvial forest has been planted. And they put down to maintain a sort of open savanna-like space on that floodplain. They put in a rebreed of an extinct wild horse. So they're experimenting with species that also predate the partition, certainly, that predate the wars, right? Both of them that predate, right, that take us back, that remind us. They're almost like these wild animals, whether it's heck cattle in the southern part of the Greenbelt, or it's these wild horse, these rebreeds of a wild, extinct wild, the tarpan of a wild horse. I argue in the book that these are sort of genetic holograms of a lost age. It's a way for people to play with memory and play with a sense of the past without necessarily, you know, relocating people out of the floodplain or like, so these are open air experiments, as it were, with ecological dynamics, with prior species that perhaps grazed on that floodplain thousands of years ago, while also avoiding some of the land use conflicts, because a lot of East Germans, again, they don't want this land taken away. They've been using that land. They don't want to be displaced. This can't be a national park, but it could be a biosphere reserve where some human activity is allowed. Yeah, so these animals within them carry some kind of memory, genetic memory of the past. And these ecological processes, the river flow that's being restored, the behavior of the river that a river will have absent human modification is also a way to remember ecologically what pre-existed human modification, right? It goes back to the past. And the Germans are really orienting themselves according to an ecological baseline they think might have existed in sort of the early first half of the 19th century, which is sort of an interesting decision as well. But yeah, I argue that ecologies themselves, plants, animals, landscape, ecological dynamics themselves get enrolled in this sort of memorial project in other ways, right? And then once you do that, you're introducing a certain kind of serendipity, a certain kind of unsteeredness, a certain kind of unpredictability into your work as well. And I think that's really instructive too, right? Like, what do you do when the river actually doesn't behave like you thought it would, or when, what happens when, you know, when the horses want to migrate somewhere else or are not doing the work you thought they might do, or they're not grazing fast enough, or they're grazing too much, or yeah. So there are interesting implications to that approach.
Because these ecosystems they're trying to create, they're trying to do this at high speed, right? And no one really knows how it's going to actually work out. These environments that were destroyed over a long period of time, they're trying to revive them. But what I thought was interesting is that you mentioned, well, they have a certain vision of they're trying to conserve or restore something. But, you know, if you're a tourist, you're walking through you walk through these areas, you don't really know what that landscape is. You don't know what the intentions of the decision makers are, but they're looking at maps from a particular time period. They're drawing from a history that orients them towards a certain era. It's that gravitational force of the Heimat seems to be pulling them back to that early 19th century. And they do that because maybe that's a powerful sense of connection that people have. They realize that you were going to relate to a place if you see species, plants, or animals that you see as German that are important to your homeland, your sense of belonging. You want to get behind that. But you mentioned there's a darker side to that too, that they kind of just try to avoid, right? That on the one hand, that these green spaces, they're looked as refuges. And there's this political project that's behind all this in terms of how this is seen as a project that can heal, that can unite, but by tapping into a certain past, certain memories, and Germany is a bigger country than that. It's a more diverse country than that. So you wonder, well, you know, who gets left out?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, right? Conservation historically has been, its task has basically been to erase human history, right? That's been the task of conservation, to free up spaces and take the human imprint out of them. And so what's happening in Germany is radically different, right? Like you're trying to maintain a human imprint to a certain extent, or you're trying to recreate a landscape that harkens back to a pre-partition German past, an agrarian tradition, the cultural landscape from like the 1820s or so, where environments were already compromised. But this is sort of like some people that I spoke to said, this is the best compromise that we have, A, because we have data on what that landscape looked like, but B, it allows people to actually interact with the landscape, right? We don't want to cordon off these spaces. We want these to be accessible to people. People should be able to go for walks in this space, right? Because you want to recreate or want to allow that place attachment, that love for these places, that people accept these places and love them for the amenities that they provide or the emotional connection that they can have to these, because that'll make the conservation project sustainable, right? It runs on itself. If people care enough about the project, they will support it both financially and with their, you know, the volunteer labor and whatnot. And conservation has done a very good job over the last century and a half to alienate people from places. So I think the Greenbelt Project is doing the right thing overall. But a lot of the people I spoke with keep referencing Heimat, and the written materials will use Heimat or versions thereof, beheimatet, right? So the species that are beheimatet in a space that are native or belong into this space, right? And so, like you said, there's an emphasis on keeping German environments German and allowing German species to recolonize or re-inhabit German spaces. And I warn in the book of, like, there's this catch-22. I think Heimat does the important work. It's a concept that is readily available in German discourse. It means something to people, and it does the important work of validating and making visible people's attachment and love for land, love for their places, and love for their past, and love for their you know, youth experience, and all this sort of stuff, and emphasizes their belonging. But it has, as the Second World War experience has shown us, of course, also that sort of dark side of blood and soil belonging, blood and soil nationalism, right? One person's belonging is another person's alienation, potentially, right? So to what extent do we use Heimat, and can conservationists use Heimat in and just emphasize its positives? But to what extent does the use of Heimat, Germans for Germans, the German Heimat for Germans, and, you know, the Greenbelt, as you suggested, is closely tied to the story of reunification, that the Greenbelt is seen as this suture, that nature is the thing that sutures the scar of partition, right? It's the thing that exceeds human interests. It's the great unifier of West Germans and East Germans. And then the question is, to what extent has that storyline or that narrative or that vision run its course when we're actually talking about, we're now 30, 40 years on from that? To what extent are we, when we are dealing with, especially post 2015 and the Merkel's decision to admit a lot of Syrian refugees, and German society is changing, and not just temporally, where you have younger generations coming up who don't really relate to a partition Germany, but you have a much more ethnically, racially diverse, religiously diverse Germany. And to what extent does an insistence on Germany as a unifier, like the Greenbelt as the unifier of Germans and of German Heimat, resonate with any of that? Like, is Heimat going to be discordant with the needs of, you know, of contemporary Germany, I think is a question that I pose in the book and sort of would like people to be thinking about. To what extent can the Greenbelt become the Heimat of many, not just East, former East and West Germans, but the Heimat of contemporary Germans, right? To what extent can it become, can it speak to other kinds of union or other kinds of, like, to what extent can it allow people to feel at home in Germany more broadly? I think these are sort of challenges as we're sort of facing, future-oriented challenges. I mean, they're present-day challenges, but ways in which the Greenbelt should be thinking about its future. I think that's really important.
Sonja, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Rick.
Sonja Peek is a professor of environmental studies at Bates College in Maine. She's the author of Mnemonic Ecologies, Memory and Nature Conservation Along the Former Iron Curtain. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.